The MA-17 trial evaluating the delayed use of letrozole after 5 years of adjuvant tamoxifen changed the paradigm of long-term management of estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer. At a satellite meeting in San Antonio last December, Dr. Aman Buzdar presented a case from his practice who exemplified this challenge. The patient is a 75-year-old woman treated with adjuvant chemotherapy for a node-positive, ER-positive tumor in 1993. The patient declined adjuvant tamoxifen, and 6 years later, she was diagnosed with metastatic disease. I met with Dr. Buzdar to discuss this case and the entire issue of long-term endocrine management, and he began our conversation by commenting on the very limited data available on delayed adjuvant endocrine therapy in patients without prior endocrine treatment.
There was a very old study with tamoxifen, which was done almost like 18 years ago, where the patients who were hormone receptor positive and they never received adjuvant therapy, and from several months to several years delay in initiating the endocrine therapy with tamoxifen, substantially improved the disease-free survival of these patients. So I think these women, if we can identify the high-risk women, we may be able to intervene early, instead of waiting for the cancer to recur, do something to prevent the recurrence.
And, of course, the other issue is the woman who has had tamoxifen. Maybe she's been off it for a couple years or even 5 years. And, again, the same kind of a thing. Would you consider a delayed AI in that situation?
I think more and more data is coming towards that, although we don't have a clean randomized trial. That I think the thing which we are learning, that breast cancer, which is a hormone-dependent breast cancer, ER-positive, even though we give systemic chemotherapy, give 5 years of endocrine therapy, that may not be adequate because the risk of recurrence is substantial and it continues even up to 10, 15, or even 20 years data from the Oxford overview continues to show that for ER-positive patients, the curves continue to go downward, whereas the ER-negative patients' curves tend to more or less plateau. So the risk of recurrence is substantial and it is continued. So I think there are studies which I am aware of people are planning to address this question, delayed introduction of endocrine therapy in patients who are at a risk of developing recurrence of cancer, especially AIs, to see whether we can do that.
Part of the issue, too, is, you know, we have this new sensitivity about delayed relapse in ER-positive patients. At least docs in practice have a great idea about how high that risk is. You know, for example, let's say you have a woman who got 5 years of tamoxifen, now it's 5 years later. How do you figure out what her residual risk might be?
I think that is a very good question. I think we maybe have some models to come up from the data which is available. You could get some estimate, but in an individual patient right now, we don't have anything like, say, adjuvant online or things like that. I think it might be good which physicians could have an access to a very quick information. But if you just look at simple characteristic of the disease, if a patient has a larger tumor, if a patient has positive nodes, if patient is now still young, if she has a life expectancy of several decades, it means that she has a continued exposure of risk, and that risk should be attenuated because now we have therapies which can attenuate the risk.
And, you know, I guess the other thing is that, you know, now we just saw another data set, the NSABP B33, looking at delayed XMS stain after tamoxifen. And it was fascinating because the trial had to stop because the MA-17 data came out. There was contamination. It was unblinded. Patients stopped the therapy. They started therapy. And yet, in spite of all that, they saw a significant reduction in delayed relapse. What were your thoughts about that study?
Well, I think it confirms the MA-17 data very strongly that with a much smaller sample size, with crossover, which happened after the data of MA-17 became available, in spite of that, you see significant reduction in the relapses of breast cancer, which is remarkable. And I think it supports the evidence that these patients are at a continued risk and that risk should be attenuated.
I guess the other thing relevant to your case is it's so tragic. I see these cases. I know they're not common, but they're the kind of cases people want to present when we have our meetings. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm thinking, wow, maybe somebody should have thought a year before. If you'd only thought about it a couple years, maybe this metastatic disease could have been prevented, all the things that happened with this woman. How was she actually diagnosed with metastatic disease? Did she have symptoms?
No, actually, she was very asymptomatic. Somehow, she went for evaluation and somebody ordered a tumor marker, CA2729, and
right.
It was elevated. And then we started to look for the reason, and then we found the hepatic metastases.
What was her life situation at that point?
She's actually fully functional, 100% performance status, totally asymptomatic.
What was her reaction when she was diagnosed?
Any patient reaction is that patient, anytime you tell them that first you have a cancer and then you tell them the cancer has recurred, it is almost the next question comes in the mind, when I'm going to die. But the thing is still, I think, very good from our patient point of view that there are effective therapies which can palliate these patients for some time, maybe even for decades. With appropriate utilization of currently available endocrine therapies, systemic therapies, we have shown from MD Anderson data, and there are now other studies which clearly show that metastatic disease you may not be able to eradicate, but you may be able to control it for an extended period of time. And I have some patients in which we have disease under control for maybe a decade or longer.
But I don't know whether anybody's looked recently to see, you know, sort of what the median survival is now today of metastatic breast cancer. I'm sure it depends on whether it's ER positive, HER2 positive, et cetera. I mean, the old numbers were like 2 or 3 years.
No, but we published our data very recently, about 2-3 years ago. The survival we looked at, it was a very interesting subgroup of consecutive series of patients who were in the adjuvant trials. These were all patients who were prospectively, after diagnosis, were into adjuvant trials, registered trials at MD Anderson. So we looked at those patients who recurred. And first trial which we started was in 1975. So the patients who failed in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, and in the 2000s. If you look at it, there is a progressive, stepwise improvement in survival. And you can stack, actually we have, this was published in Cancer, and on the other side you can stack the number of drugs which FDA has approved for treatment of cancer. The survival curve is always stepwise going up.
But I mean, still, what are you looking at in terms of median survival?
In ER-positive patients, median survival will be at least close to 4 years now.
So in these patients who have ER-positive disease, one of the questions, let's assume that it's HER2 negative, such as this patient, mm-hmm. obviously is whether chemo is going to be introduced or the patient's going to get hormone therapy. This woman had liver metastasis, and yet you used hormone therapy alone. What was your thinking there?
The logic of introducing endocrine therapy is that a lot of times our gut reaction is that we need to go with chemotherapy right away. In adjuvant setting, and also, I think there are very limited data in metastatic setting, that when you have a hormone-dependent tumor, if you compare the efficacy of the two class of agents, endocrine agents versus chemotherapy, actually endocrine agents are better for hormone-dependent tumors because these are far more targeted therapies, whereas the chemotherapy is a shotgun therapy you are offering to them. So that is the reason that I elected to go with the endocrine therapy. Only time I will go with the chemotherapy in a patient with metastatic disease who is hormone dependent if they have an organ which is vital and it is involved, that it may compromise the quality of life or the patient may go rapidly downhill. For example, lymphangitic spread. Or if this lady had extensive hepatic involvement with marked derangement of her liver functions, then I would maybe inclined in ER-positive patient to go with the chemotherapy, try to get cytoreduction, and then switch her to endocrine therapy.
Now, what about the sequence of endocrine therapy in postmenopausal patients? What do you generally do or recommend, and what are the options that you consider?
It all depends on the prior exposure of endocrine therapy and also the age of the patient. If a patient is postmenopausal, patient never had the endocrine therapy in the adjuvant setting, I think the first choice is now aromatase inhibitors. Right now we have 2 aromatase inhibitors which have well-established FDA-approved indication, anastrozole and letrozole, both. They clearly demonstrate that their anti-tumor activity is better in the metastatic setting In other words, a higher fraction of patients, you get the control of the disease, and the control of the disease is longer than what we would have achieved with tamoxifen if we offer to the patient, and the patients overall experience fewer side effects.
What about an AI versus fulvestrant?
The thing is that when we look at the data of one trial where fulvestrant was compared against tamoxifen, unfortunately, it did not show higher response rate, did not show longer control of disease. But that study had a lot of shortcomings because it had a lot of patients which were hormone receptor unknown, and some of them would be hormone receptor negative. But in receptor positive patients, actually the drug looked at least as good as tamoxifen. Fulvestrant looked as good as tamoxifen.
Of course, it's also been compared to anastrozole.
It was compared, but that study which was done, where fulvestrant was compared against anastrozole, these were patients who had previously been treated and have been treated with tamoxifen, and they were tamoxifen resistant. So that was a second line setting.
So the patient receives an aromatase inhibitor as first line therapy, has a response, and then progresses. What's your usual second line therapy?
If a patient receives aromatase inhibitor as a first line, then you have, I think, two choices. Either you can go from non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor to a steroidal aromatase inhibitor, or you have a choice of estrogen receptor downregulator like fulvestrant. Those are the two choices which have significant anti-tumor activity in this type of situation. Whereas if you talk about 10 years ago, it would have been progestins. But I think now those drugs are moved further down the line, so we don't use them as a second-line therapy or first-line therapy.
What about tamoxifen? Again, assuming the patient's just had an AI.
Tamoxifen would be a reasonable option in that type of setting too. But again, if you look at the safety profile of these tamoxifen versus, say, aromatase inhibitor, overall I would say that aromatase inhibitor, doesn't matter which aromatase inhibitor you look at it, it has a better safety profile than tamoxifen.
So what would your normal or your most common choice be then after an aromatase inhibitor?
It would be from non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor will be to steroidal aromatase inhibitor like aromacin or fulvestrant.
And how would you make that decision?
I think I would discuss with each patient to see that some patients will say that, oh, I want to have a therapy which I can have a control, and some patients want to have a therapy which they don't want to do anything and let us do something. That way you can give an injection at regular intervals and they don't have to worry about it taking something every day to remind them of cancer.
Now, you were one of the investigators on the EFFECT trial that was just reported by Bill Gradishar. Can you talk about what that study looked at, what the eligibility and design was, and what was seen?
That study was actually very simple, because the thing is that, as we just talked, that there are data which are available for non-steroidal to steroidal aromatase inhibitors showing that steroidal aromatase inhibitor have activity in patients who have been treated with anastrozole or letrozole before. And there are phase 2 data which show that fulvestrant has anti-tumor activity. But we didn't have any good clean phase 3 data to show whether these drugs will have similar efficacy or one would be better than the other. So this EFFECT trial was a very bold attempt, I think, on the part of industry and the academia to head-on compare, and also to compare it in a way that the data is credible and it can stand the scrutiny. It was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial. So neither the patient nor the doctor knew what drug is the patient taking. And the results, which were not surprising, that as a third-line therapy, you see that both drugs have activity which is of modest degree, about a third of the patient getting clinical benefit, and the benefit was identical between the two groups of patients.
Now, when you say third-line therapy, I thought these patients just had an AI before this.
The average these patients had previously tamoxifen also.
Tamoxifen also, right.
But a very high percent of patients had tamoxifen.
I see. If you look at the numbers involved, do you think this trial was adequately powered to detect, you know, a significant difference?
I think that if you wanted to see very small differences, you will need much larger sample size. But with the sample size as it was designed, I think it answered the question that at least both drugs have very good activity and you can palliate about a third of the patient.
Now, one of the interesting things about this study and a lot of the other current studies on fulvestrin is they use the loading dose. I believe they gave 500 milligrams initially, 250 after 2 weeks, and then 250 at 4 weeks and 250 a month. And the first question asked, I think it was by George Sledge after Bill Gratishar presented this, was, is a loading dose now standard of care for fulvestrin? How would you answer that question?
I think the thing which is very clear that when we carried out initially the phase 3 randomized trial against anastrozole, that's where we did all these PKs and the drug steady state levels. And we gave the drug at a fixed dose of 250 every 4 weeks. It took a while. One question was, in that period, before the patient gets to a steady state level, when there is subtherapeutic level of the drug, are the patients progressing that drug is ineffective, or there is not enough drug on board and the disease is progressing? So the design of this study was to bring a therapeutic range very quickly by giving the loading dose. And we showed that. The question which we don't have the answer is this the best approach? Our conventional, if we would have given it every 4 weeks, would have achieved the same results. But you can only say the way the drug was administered and when we compare it against another drug, the efficacy looks similar. So I think if I have to use the drug in a clinical practice in this type of setting, I will be using as the drug was utilized in the protocol.
So right now in your practice, outside a protocol setting, do you always use a loading dose of fulvestrin?
I personally, even before the data came out, I use it loading dose so that this question should not be lingering in my mind or the patient mind that, oh, maybe if we would have waited longer enough, that I would have responded. So that way, if the patient responds, well and good. But if a patient didn't respond, you can't say that, oh, because the drug did not reach to a steady state and you didn't have the opportunity to observe the patient long enough.
Now, sort of the flip side of increasing the dose is to decrease the level of estrogens, the competitor, so to speak. And one of the strategies that's being looked at in several trials that we don't have any data from is combining an AI with fulvestrin. Can you talk a little bit more about the rationale for that and what you think that approach is going to show?
Actually, Angela Brody has done a lot of experimental data and a lot of preclinical work. In the preclinical data, actually, tamoxifen and AIs did not show any synergy, whereas aromatase inhibitors, when they are combined with fulvestrin, there is a substantial prolonged suppression of the aromatase-expressing cell lines in experimental models. So I think that is one of the important questions, and it is a very important preclinical lead. There is at least one or two trials which are ongoing right now, which will answer some of these questions, and those studies are ongoing in Europe and some other parts of the world.
Well, also, I think, is it SWOG? I think there's a U.S. trial.
There is
also
one SWOG study is ongoing, too.
Are there any situations where you might use that strategy off-study?
My feeling is that I would not use it, the reason being that in endocrine therapy, 1 plus 1 has remained 1, and there is quite compelling preclinical data, and we have to wait until we have the data which would suggest that there is some synergy or either higher response rate or longer control of the disease before I would use that approach.
Although one may be exception to that 1 plus 1 rule, and kind of similar strategy is to use ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen or ovarian suppression plus an AI. Is that a strategy you use in metastatic setting?
In metastatic setting, I would use occasionally a patient who is premenopausal, I would use AI plus ovarian suppression. But I think it is better to use the endocrine therapies in sequential manner in a palliative intent. You get longer control of the disease because once patient becomes resistant, you have something else available to offer to the patient.
So a typical situation of a premenopausal woman who, for example, relapses while she's on adjuvant tamoxifen, you want to use hormonal therapy. What is usually going to be your next therapy, assuming she's still menstruating and premenopausal?
If she's still menstruating, then I would use either ovarian ablation by surgical means or pharmacological means and then given AI.
Not ovarian suppression alone?
I usually do not do it. I usually do it together.
Yeah, I mean, that's our patterns of care study show that that is typically what's going on right now. So let's say you do that, you give ovarian suppression plus an AI, the patient has a good response and then progresses, then what?
Yeah, I think that then if you want to switch from non-steroidal to a steroidal AI, you have to maintain the ovarian suppression. Or if you want to go to, say, fulvestrant, because most of the data from fulvestrant is also in postmenopausal patients, you have to maintain the patient in a physiological postmenopausal status to treat them with these type of agents.
Anything else going on right now in clinical research and hormonal therapy that you find interesting or exciting?
I think the question which has become very clear now, that aromatase inhibitors are better than tamoxifen, and questions which we don't have the answer from the prospective studies, is it just giving aromatase inhibitor for 5 years is optimal therapy, or switching them to another endocrine agent after X period of time, are utilizing in a sequential manner several endocrine agents. And the optimal duration of AIs also we don't know. And some of these studies are ongoing, and some of the studies, I think, are on the planning phase, and they will address some of these questions.
What are you doing in your practice off-study in patients who hit 5 years on an AI?
I think the NSABP study, since we are part of the NSABP, we offer that to our patient to see that if they want to be part of that clinical trial, because I think that's a very important pivotal trial which can answer that question relatively quickly if we put our patients into that type of study.
What about the issue of resistance to endocrine therapy? You hear more and more talk about, you know, crosstalk with HER2 and other pathways. Anything along those lines that you think is going to lead to something clinically meaningful in the next few years?
One study which looked very interesting was that patients who are estrogen receptor positive, postmenopausal, and also they were HER2 new positive. That tandem trial in which the anastrozole alone versus anastrozole plus a HER2 new antibody trastuzumab was given, that the patients who got combination of two therapies, there was longer control of the disease, higher number of patients got clinical benefit. And I think close to 2/3 of the patients were subsequently given the trastuzumab therapy. So I think the survival we may not be able to see from that study, but there was suggestive evidence that in spite of that, patients tend to have numerically slightly better survival even in that study. So I think those type of approaches where you combine biologics or targeted therapy, which may be certain pathways of resistance, as this field is evolving, I think, and we understand somewhat more that what are the mechanisms of endocrine resistance, we may be able to either prevent resistance or reverse resistance in these patients.
Now, that presentation by John Mackey caused a little bit of a stir in the audience about the practical significance of this. And does this really mean that for patients like this, they should generally get started on trastuzumab plus hormonal therapy or employ more of a sequential approach? What's been your approach to these patients in the past, and is that changing at all with these new data?
I think these data are real. And from the ATAC data, the tumors which were HER2 new positive and ER positive, actually, our thinking used to be that, oh, aromatase inhibitors are much better therapy for these patients. Actually, it is not. Both tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors work suboptimally in these patients. So I think the questions which were being raised that, oh, maybe we can use these sequentially and we get the same advantage, I think it may not be true, because these tumors are biologically different. And the benefit from endocrine therapy, even with aromatase inhibitor in HER2 new positive patient, is very modest, and it is both with anti-estrogens and also with aromatase inhibitors. So I think that tandem trial did provide a fairly strong positive lead. And if I see a patient, I think I would discuss that approach with the patient, that starting both therapies up long, we may be able to control the disease for a longer period of time.
And that's new. So 6 months ago, you weren't doing that?
6 months ago, I would have not done it. But I think this data just came out in the early part of September. So I think it is a situation we need to discuss with the patient.
I guess the other thing people pointed out about that, consistent with what you're saying, is that the patients with a HER2 positive, ER positive metastatic disease in TAM who just got anastrozole progressed very quickly.
That is absolutely true.
What about the possibility of combining bevacizumab and hormonal therapy? We're starting to see just a little bit of data on that. I don't think there are any answers. Where do you think that's heading?
I think that is an important research question, that whether combining that in hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative patients, whether that will keep the disease under control for a longer period of time, higher number of patients will benefit, or will have a favorable impact. I would not do it outside the context of clinical trial, but I think that is an area which is ready to do an appropriate clinical trial to answer that question.
I want to talk a little bit about HER2 positive disease. Another major story out of San Antonio was, I guess it was the very first presentation looking at neoadjuvant lapatinib in inflammatory breast cancer. Can you talk a little bit about what that study looked at, and then we'll get into how that might relate to the study you did?
I think that study showed two important things. One important thing it showed is that there was a small period where the patients were just receiving lapatinib alone. And there were patients who were showing antitumor activity or regression of the disease just with monotherapy.
And that was 2 weeks treatment.
Yeah, there was a substantial number of patients showed regression of the disease.
It reminded me of Jenny Chang's study in neoadjuvant therapy with trastuzumab, where I think she had that 3-week run-in period and saw these responses. What were your thoughts about that?
I think it shows that the drug has substantial antitumor activity in the untreated patient population.
You said that was one point. What was the other point?
Other point is that when you combine it with chemotherapy, paclitaxel weekly for 12 doses, and the patients showed a very high clinical response rate, and a small number of patients had a pathological complete remission, which is extremely important because we reported our own experience, even with inflammatory carcinoma, that if a patient has a pathological complete remission, about 90% of those patients, even with inflammatory carcinoma of the breast, will remain alive free of disease beyond 10 plus years.
What do we know about the biology of inflammatory breast cancer? One of the things that they were presenting were some of the genes, et cetera. What do we know about that?
Well, I think there is a lot of genes which are over-amplified in these inflammatory carcinoma of the breast, which show that this is biologically a totally different disease, which has a far more rapid clinical downhill course without appropriate therapy. Before the era of combined modality approach, the median survival from diagnosis to death for these patients used to be that within 2 years, 95% of these patients used to be dead. Now, with the standard anthracycline-based therapies, local therapies, and the radiation, you have about 30 to 40% of the patients who are remaining alive free of disease, but still 60 to 70% of the patients die from the disease. So it clearly demonstrates that this is biologically different disease which has far more grave prognosis compared to the patients with locally advanced or T4 disease.
Focusing just on the whole general issue of neoadjuvant therapy of HER2 positive disease, can you provide an update of your study that you presented a couple years ago at ASCO and sort of where the field is heading in terms of the strategy?
I think that our study, which we talked about it 2 years ago and it was published in JCO, where we wanted to do a fairly modest size randomized clinical trial to see chemotherapy versus chemotherapy with trastuzumab in a neoadjuvant setting to see whether PAD-CR rate can be enhanced. And our study clearly demonstrated that you could get close to 60%+ of the patients having a pathological complete remission with no invasive cancer either in the breast or in the lymph node. We recently updated that study, and we have treated another 22 patients with identical approach with chemo and Herceptin, and that data is actually in the next few weeks in Clinical Cancer Research. So far, from the 19 patients who were in the control group, 3 have recurred and 1 of 3 have died. Whereas out of the randomized initial 23 patients, not a single patient with a 3-year follow-up has recurred. All patients remain alive free of disease. And out of the 22 additional patients which we have treated, pathological complete response rate was identical to our earlier experience. And also, that subgroup of patients still continues to remain alive free of disease. So out of 45 patients which we have treated with trastuzumab and chemotherapy with paclitaxel and FEC, we have not seen a single recurrence, and we have not seen a single patient who had a clinical cardiac dysfunction.
And overall, the complete response rate is about what?
It's close to 60%.
And I guess one of the controversial things about that study was the use of trastuzumab concurrent with an anthracycline. What's happening in terms of cardiac safety?
In our patient population, we have extensively studied those patients. All patients do show, when you give trastuzumab and anthracycline, subclinical drop in the ejection fraction. But clinical cardiac dysfunction has not been observed. And there is a large trial which we're going to hopefully start soon through the American College of Surgical Cooperative Oncology Group, which will have about 400-plus patients, which will address this question, that what is the safer or optimal way to administer trastuzumab in a preoperative or a neoadjuvant setting? Can we safely use it as we did at MD Anderson? Or one of the other arm in that will be that patients will get 4 cycles of FEC without trastuzumab, and then trastuzumab will be introduced during the paclitaxel phase, and patients will have local therapy after 24 weeks of chemotherapy and trastuzumab.
So the only difference will be whether or not they get the trastuzumab during the FEC.
That's right.
You know, there was a lot of discussion about a trial like that. I know the NSABP was talking about it at that one point. It kind of seems like the cooperative groups have gotten more interest in the issue of lapatinib or lapatinib plus trastuzumab. Is that your take?
Well, I think that always there is interest when you have a newer molecule. The question is that there are a number of studies which are going to address the question. That first question is the drug as good as trastuzumab? And does the drug combined with trastuzumab have reasonably good safety? And does it enhance the antitumor activity? And there are a number of neoadjuvant studies which are ongoing or being designed to evaluate that question. And I think we will see a lot more exciting data come out in the next few years.
What about the study that was presented at ASCO looking at capecitabine versus capecitabine plus lapatinib that, you know, kind of led to the conclusion that there's a significant prolongation in progression-free survival with the lapatinib? What were your thoughts about that study, and do you have any criticism of the conclusions?
No, I think that study clearly demonstrates that lapatinib has substantial antitumor activity, and even in the second-line therapy, where bevacizumab evaluated in that type of setting actually did not show much improvement in the time to progression or higher response rate, whereas over here, addition of lapatinib with same drug substantially increased the response rates significantly higher, and control of the disease was 50% longer. So I think the drug has substantial antitumor activity, and that study design is very clean, in my judgment.
What do we know about the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab?
There is actually a study which we are doing. It is going to be a multi-institutional study in a metastatic setting right now. We are doing it, and there are other studies which are on the drawing board under review in a different type of setting. Develop what is the optimal dose of the drug lapatinib which can be safely combined, because both drugs have different toxicities. And then if you are going to do it with chemotherapy, you have to develop a combination in which these two novel agents can be combined. And then question would be, so right now we are in a process of doing a phase 1-2 type of study to determine in HER2-new positive patients that what is the optimal dose of lapatinib which can be combined.
If lapatinib were available right now to you or non-protocol treatment, how would you integrate it into your practice?
Right now, the data is in patients who have been previously treated with trastuzumab. So I would use it in those patients who have been previously treated and have become refractory.
What about the patient who's had adjuvant trastuzumab and now has relapsed sometime after stopping the trastuzumab?
Well, I think that will be another appropriate type of setting. But the thing we have learned from the previous experience, it depends on how soon the patient relapses. If a patient relapses within 4 to 6 months, then obviously that patient is resistant to trastuzumab and whatever chemotherapy she had received. But if it is 2 years or 3 years down the line, in half of the patients, even though it didn't cure the disease, you may see objective regression of the disease with the same therapies.
Did you attend the Oxford Overview meeting this past fall?
Yeah. I've gone to all of their meetings because I contribute a lot of data into that studies.
Right. Those meetings are always interesting. Mm-hmm. What came out at this year's meeting that you think is clinically relevant?
I think that there are several things which, some of the things which reinforce our previous observations. The thing which reinforces our previous observation is that chemotherapy is very effective in reducing the risk of recurrence and death, and anthracycline-based therapies are superior than non-anthracycline-based therapy. Whereas with the tamoxifen, the data which will be presented is that, yes, tamoxifen continues to show significant reduction in the risk of recurrence, which is about 50% risk of recurrence is reduced, and about 30% reduction in the risk of death. There is two studies, ATOM and ATLAS trial, which are 5 versus 10 years of therapy. And the thing is that even though NSABP study and Scottish trial showed that the longer duration of tamoxifen was associated with somewhat poorer outcome, in this ATLAS and ATOM studies combined data, it does not show that. There is slight but statistically significant further reduction in the risk of recurrence. There is no survival advantage up till now. But the other side of the coin is that as you expose the patient to the longer duration of anti-estrogen therapy, side effects which are life-changing or life-threatening also continue to go up. So when you look at the data, there is about 2% of the patients die from tamoxifen-related events which are not due to breast cancer. So the thing is that we have to see how that data matures before we say that, oh, maybe longer tamoxifen therapy may be better for the patient.
So this is an excess risk of mortality that's 5 and 10 years down the line.
Mm-hmm.
I heard sort of rumors about that. It's interesting. I remember in the 2000 NIH consensus conference, PETA was up there, you know, raising hell, saying, hey, listen, the duration of tamoxifen question really hasn't been answered. Of course, he was running those trials, and it's funny that by the time it got answered, it sort of became obsolete because people are into AIs nowadays.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I guess.
And other problem with that ATOM and ATLAS trial, which is kind of unfortunate, is because they were run in the parts of the world where majority of patients, we don't have the estrogen receptors. But close to 2/3 of the patients, there is no receptor inflammation.
Wow, I didn't know that.
That was very surprising. The other thing which was interesting from these data was that they did a meta-analysis of aromatase inhibitors. And they looked at it very simplistic way. Any type of setting, aromatase inhibitors were given upfront after 2 to 3 years, or like MA-17 type of study design, versus no aromatase inhibitors. When you look at it, actually the data is very convincing and very striking, that there was significant reduction in the risk of recurrence, and this was across these studies, and pool data shows that. And also when you look at this, that there is reduction in the risk of death. So the question which came up is, oh, that you're putting a lot of these groups together. But I think one of the things which came out, that it essentially refutes the null hypothesis that our thinking was, oh, maybe by giving aromatase inhibitors either upfront or after 2 to 3 years of tamoxifen or at the end, you may be delaying the recurrence and not having any impact on the survival. There is statistically significant reduction in risk of death by looking at these data. And right now we are in a process of getting like to like, comparing appropriate subgroups of patients, like, say, upfront aromatase inhibitor after 2 to 3 years or MA-17 type of, and then looking at the subgroup analysis, that may provide far more clearer information.
Another thing that I had heard was looked at in the overview was this controversial question about the effect of chemo based on hormone receptor status. Can you talk about what was presented there?
Yeah, I think the chemotherapy, there were several questions which was very clear. One was that patients who were hormone-independent tumors, or ER-negative tumors, benefit of chemotherapy was independent of age. And proportional reduction in the risk of recurrence and death was very similar regardless of the age. Second question which actually came out from that Oxford overview, which is very interesting and very impressive, is that does inclusion of taxane further reduce the risk of recurrence or not? There is unequivocal evidence to show that taxane included in the treatment of early stage breast cancer further reduces the risk of recurrence and reduces the risk of death. And this benefit was independent of the ER status. Third thing was that looking at it, does the chemotherapy work in ER positive patients or does it have more modest effect? Actually, when you look at it, In the Oxford overview, the shortcoming is that you know either the patient is ER positive or ER negative. We don't know that. We don't have the value of the receptor. So when you take with a broader yardstick, the benefit of chemotherapy is very similar in ER positive and ER negative patients.
Compared to control?
Compared to the patient, yes.
Hmm.
But this was previous Oxford overview, which was published in 2005. When you compare chemotherapy to tamoxifen in ER-positive patients, tamoxifen is a better treatment than chemotherapy alone.
But the question is, does chemotherapy add to hormonal therapy?
There is no question that chemotherapy adds substantially to further reduce the risk of recurrence and further reduce the risk of death.
And you're saying it adds the same proportional risk reduction as in ER-negative tumors?
It is more modest because you have a biologically different disease, and over there you see a much striking difference because you are giving one modality, whereas you are essentially over there comparing to nothing. Over here you are comparing to another effective therapy, which is patients are receiving.
It's interesting. There have been so much discussion about this question of chemotherapy and ER-positive disease. Where do you think that's heading? And where do you think assays like the Oncotype DX are going to fit in solving this?
I think we are heading to the direction that there would be, in the near future, my feeling, that we would be able to identify subset of ER-positive patients where we could say that addition of chemotherapy would give you very modest or very little additional gains except substantial morbidity and toxicity, acute and long-term. And we may be able to identify the subgroups in which we can say that, oh, even though your tumor is hormone-positive, the majority of benefit might come from chemotherapy. And I think a couple of trials which are ongoing, one in the U.S. and one in Europe, those are going to address that question, because I think we are getting there, and in the next few years we may be able to further define that which are the ER-positive patients in which we could avoid chemotherapy and get the similar benefit. But right now I don't think we are there.
And you're talking about the TAILOR-Rx and the MINDEC trial.
That's it. Those two trials, I think, will address that question.
And I guess, you know, one of the questions is certainly it would be great to avoid giving chemotherapy, but also to make sure that it's given to women who are going to benefit. I mean, the preliminary data that came out of the NSABB-B20 study showed the high recurrence story patients had, you know, 75% reduction in recurrence with chemotherapy. So there's a group of ER-positive patients that were pretty sensitive to chemotherapy. At least that was my read. Is that yours?
I think my read on those studies which were done with Oncotype DX, they are all retrospective look at the data. And this prospective trial, which we are doing now in the U.S. and in Europe, I think those will be the ones which will identify and answer this question that prospectively that, yes, addition of chemotherapy, if you have this score or this tumor profile, you would benefit from addition of chemotherapy.
I want to swing back for a final point or discussion here. I'm curious what your thoughts were about Dennis Slamon's presentation of the BCARG study, the second time now that he's presented now with follow-up data. Can you talk about what that study looked at and where it's at right now?
My feeling of Dennis Slamon's study is that overwhelming body of evidence in adjuvant therapy has clearly established that anthracycline-based therapies are superior than non-anthracycline-based therapy. In his study, still with the updated analysis, that arm with the carboplatin is somewhat inferior, numerically inferior, although the differences may not be as striking as they were when he presented the 2-year follow-up. But still, there are more recurrences in that subset of patients. And he did not go into the details of the toxicity. He tries to paint a picture that, oh, these patients did not experience toxicity. I think whenever I use these type of combinations in metastatic disease, these platinum-based compounds have substantial toxicity also, which at times could be sizable to these patients who are postmenopausal.
Well, I guess the one thing he was particularly emphasizing was cardiac toxicity.
Cardiac toxicity, I think, he is blowing way out of proportion. I think the benefit, the way anthracycline-based chemotherapies, because the tumors which are HER2-new positive are also the same type of tumors which are also Topo II positive. Very small number of patients will be TOPO2 overexpressed, but they will be HER2 negative. If you look at what is that number is anywhere from 1 to 11%, because it is in the same amplicons, and they are most of the time co-amplified. So I personally think that I would not change my practice based on that data.
What is the regimen that you're using right now for most patients?
Our approach in those type of patients at MD Anderson is that if they come in a neoadjuvant setting, what we just talked about, that's what we offer to the patient. If the patient has already local therapy, then we will use the NSABP type of approach.
What were your thoughts about the TOPO2 data he presented this year?
I wrote an editorial, actually, a few months ago in JCO about this TOPO2 thing. I think TOPO2 it has some merit, but the question is that right now we have no standard test. We don't know what we are measuring, and everybody might be measuring something different and calling TOPO2 overexpression. I think we need to develop assays which are consistent, and it needs to be prospectively looked at to see whether it merits therapy-based decision made on this one test. All these data are retrospective. There is no data which is prospective with TOPO2 information.
You know, just kind of looking at those slides, it looked like the story that was being told last year from that trial, i.e. the TOPO2 would be a good way to determine whether or not to use an anthracycline with these HER2-positive patients, looked to me like it had kind of gone away.
It disappeared completely.
Yeah, so it's like gone. I was stunned.
The thing is also BCIRG-007 data, which was presented in metastatic setting in HER2-positive patients last year in ASCO, by John Forbes. That was the patients who were getting taxane, Herceptin, or taxane, Herceptin, and with the platinum compound. Platinum compound did not add to response rate, duration of response, or survival. Every endpoint was identical, except patients had substantially more toxicity. I think there may be patients who may benefit from the platinum-based compound, but we still haven't identified that.